the French might have been able to dispense with explicit references to race, because unlike the early Americans, they could assume the race of their vast majority. Be that as it may, America's founding fathers' explicit naming of whiteness as a legal prerequisite would have far-reaching social, cultural, political, and even psychological effects. On the one hand, as Matthew Fry Jacobson points out, America would embrace, and I quote here, the distinctly racial understanding of difference, end of quote. At the same time, however, as Richard Dyer would observe, the very existence of a racialized criterion, laden not only with legal, but with powerful social, cultural, and economic advantages, would engender in every newcomer to this country, this land of immigrants, and inexorably, positive photo taxes toward American whiteness. To quote Dyer, he says the following, because whiteness carries such rewards and privileges, the sense of a border that might be crossed and a hierarchy that might be climbed has produced a dynamic that has enthralled people who have had any chance at all of participating in it. Now, as mentioned, by 1870, blackness, or African descent, would also be identified as a qualifying characteristic for United States citizenship. But blackness by this time, and henceforth, would be recognized as carrying few of the fringe benefits of whiteness. As a result, between 1878 and 1952, when race was dropped as consideration for citizenship, virtually none of the immigrant aspirants to American citizenship based their claims to eligibility on alleged African descent, although one could have become a citizen by proving that one was of African descent. Rather, all but one of the 52 applicants whose cases were heard in American courts argued and sought to prove that they were white. Even those who have already succeeded in gaining recognition as white feared the possibility of losing it. Thus, in response to a court's initial refusal to recognize Syrians as white, a prominent Jewish leader expressed his fear that if the Japanese and the Syrians were definitively declared Asians, quote, it will not be a far step to declare the Jews Asiatic. As Sarah Galtieri demonstrates in her important story, a study of early 20th century Syrian immigrants, all world conceptions of difference that had been rooted in religion were quickly Americanized and gave way to a new racial awareness and became increasingly invested in whiteness.
Natural role in the social political order of America.
with a very unique and unanticipated challenge. Simply stated, Muslim immigrants to the United States are not only socially non-white, socially, legally white, socially non-white, post 9/11. Not only are they socially non-white, they are also legally and socially non-black. On this reality, one might say that they are in fact socially unraced. For many Muslims, this is not only unproblematic, it is actually normative. For them, race is the peculiar, odd, and thoroughly un-Islamic obsession of bigoted American rednecks and hypersensitive blacks. However, if Jacobson and other scholars are right, and America invariably operates on the basis of a distinctly racial understanding of difference, then race must, at least as a matter of fact, be recognized as an operative aspect of American reality. Muslim immigrants may be unraced in the sense that they remain diffident towards or opposed to any explicitly racial, i.e. non-white, commitments. But this does not mean that Americans as a whole will not socially racialize immigrant Muslims. And to the extent that such social racialization is inevitable, Muslims may be remiss in remaining racially agnostic and refusing or failing to explore the implications, liabilities, and opportunities that attend this predicament. Yet an exploration that limits itself to the role and power of American whiteness is bound to fall short, given the myopic vision of race that whiteness tends to promote. Thus, I shall argue that one must look beyond whiteness to the role and impact of American blackness in American social political history and identity formation. Now, as with race in general, and I hope everyone's listening very carefully here, I must pause here for another explanatory note. My point in highlighting the function of American blackness is emphatically not to elevate black Americans above any other people. Certainly not in terms of any inherent quality that black Americans might be presumed to possess as a biological race. In fact, my focus here is not on American blackness as a biological fact, but rather as a historical fact and an inextricably American social political experience. As an American phenomenon, blackness has been part of the experience of both blacks and whites. In fact, more than any other non-whiteness, it has contributed to the very meaning and function of whiteness itself. It is this capacity, American blackness not only informs America's self-understanding, it underwrites a number of immovable American realities, sensitivities, tendencies, norms, and possibilities, all of which are summarily blocked from view by a single-minded focus on American whiteness. Given the limitations of space, I will limit myself here to a brief adumbration of five implications of American blackness. First, American blackness represents not simply the possibility, but the actual fact of multiple American racial authenticities. Here, in fact, the utility of lumping America together with Europe as collectively the West reaches its point of diminishing return. For while whiteness may remain the primary racial connotation of American, it is not the only racial identity that denotes America. Martin Luther King Jr., Snoop Dogg, Muhammad Ali, and countless others are equally connotative of America. In fact, not only do these personalities connote America, they connote only America, not the West, and not even Africa at first blush. Indeed, one is reminded here of the powerful insight of James Baldwin, and I quote here, "Negroes," back in the 60s, "do not exist in any other country." All of this is another way of saying that, unlike their presence in Europe, blacks in America thoroughly frustrate the attempt to limit America to a single racial authenticity. Indeed, they represent the fact that there are at least two racially authentic Americans. And this is perhaps why it is primarily white people and black people who are now routinely asked the question, where are you or your parents from? Second, American blackness represents the possibility of inalienable American belongingness tied to a socially, i.e. not just legally recognized right, and expectation to descent. Simply stated, black Americans boast a publicly recognized identity indifference that was fired out of a centuries-long experience in America. While Arabs and Indo-Pakistanis also have hyphenated American identities and difference, the perception is that the discordant element in these identities were largely brought to America from without. On this perception, the more Arab or Pakistani Americans indulge their native cultural idiosyncrasies, for example, speaking Arabic or Urdu or eating banyani, whatever, the less American they are likely to be perceived to be by the dominant culture. By contrast, the more black Americans speak Ebonics, or black English, or eat fried chicken, whatever, the more American, as opposed to African, they are perceived to be. In sum, whereas American belongingness and authenticity for black Americans is easily reconciled with a degree of divergence from the American cultural norm, it is precisely their acumen at conforming to that norm that confers belongingness and authenticity upon Arabs and Indo-Pakistanis. Third, even as it represents the reality of non-white American authenticity, American blackness provides an entree into the live possibility of non-white Westernness. This is a controversial issue, and many black Americans remain resistant to this thesis. Much of this fades, however, on the recognition that black routes, that is, the routes that one takes to black Americanness, are as informative of black Americanness as are black roots, i.e. Africa. Equally vindicated is the recognition that as Westerners, black Americans are not mere consumers of some prefabricated Western civilization, but rather co-producers of Western civilization as the masses around the world have presently come to know. In the case of the U.S. in particular, American pop culture, for example, in the view of many Americans, in the view of many around the world, America's most prized and seductive export, this pop culture would be unimaginable absent the contributions of black Americans. Thus, Ali Mazrui, for example, once referred to black Americans as Afro-Saxons. And Amiri Baraka, Leroy Jones, would speak of the transformation of black Africans into a Western people. None of this is to argue, of course, that black Westerners is identical with white Westerners. But this is precisely the point. Black American Westerners constitutes an alternative modality of Westerners, ultimately a different way of understanding, of being, feeling, and thinking Western. Fourth, American blackness fundamentally informs the national conscience of America. In this capacity, it contributes in a major way to denying Americans the kind of innocence required to create and exploit problem peoples. Problem peoples are those who are deemed to possess such incontrovertibly negative qualities that those who criticize and demand change in them enjoy the luxury of seeing themselves as wholly justified, being motivated neither by prejudice, interest, nor ignorance, but by unspoiled conscience alone. On this perspective, all of the labor falls upon the problem people, that is to change what is wrong about them, while the critics are called upon to do nothing but monitor the efforts of their presumed inferiors. To be sure, America has produced problem peoples in the past, and it is blackness more than anything else that reminds her of this unlovely fact. To deny race, on the other hand, and thus blackness, is to afford America the luxury of innocence born of historical amnesia, thus facilitating the enterprise of creating yet another problem people. In fact, shorn of the reminder of blackness, it will likely be easier to shift the blame for any new bigotry to the new problem people. For whereas every negative stereotype hurled at the Negro could be turned with a into an indictment of what America herself had created, no such stigma is likely to attach to warning Americans about terrorists, violent extremists, Islamo-fascists, and threats to national security. Finally, American blackness is at the heart of an inexorable American quest for redemption, as the liberal enlightenment principles that have come to define our moral universe have cast a haunting indictment over her past, a past, according to American mythology, that was supposed to be enlightened from the beginning. This must be understood, however, in light of an important corollary to a previously mentioned fact. If whiteness is invisible as essentially a non-race, blackness is the quintessential American race. Racism in America is thus quintessentially an anti-black offense, first and foremost. At bottom, the American quest for redemption is essentially a desire to rewrite its racist past. Now, there are two competing approaches to doing this. First, and this one is favored more by conservatives, is to deny the racist fact of the past by shifting responsibility for black American woes entirely to black Americans. This is partly achieved by holding up the example of other socially non-white groups who have excelled in America, albeit under entirely different circumstances. The second approach, and this is favored more by liberals, is to try to undo the effects of the past by more effectively integrating black Americans into positions of power, wealth, and influence. On both approaches, however, it is ultimately blackness that humbles America, pricks her conscience, and reminds her that even when she is most sure of herself, proudest and most satisfied with her achievements, most certain of her might and the righteousness of her cause, she remains capable of great evil and lapses of moral judgment, for which she may ultimately need to redeem herself. My point in what I have said so far is neither to encourage immigrant Muslims to reposition themselves as blacks, nor to imply or to suggest that they could actually do so. My point is simply that understanding America through the prism of race, and most specifically American blackness, provides useful and meaningful insights and holds out possibilities and alternatives hitherto overlooked or blocked from consideration. I would like now to turn to how Muslim immigrant communities might relate to some of these insights and these possibilities. Beginning with the possibility of multiple American authenticities. Clearly, this should be of interest to Muslim immigrants who, on the one hand, want to be included as part of America, but who, as Muslims, want to be free to descend from America without being resented as racial or social political apostates. Here, in fact, we come face to face with one of the more problematic aspects of Muslim inclusion in American whiteness. In sum, whiteness provides both limited inclusion and even more limited right to dissent. In fact, the very threat of exclusion can serve as a major incentive for compromising the integrity of one's faith. In other words, one may find oneself in the position of being able to prove one's loyalty and commitment to a white worldview and cultural orthodoxy to which one is supposed to belong, only by relaxing one's public commitments to Islam or forfeiting one's right to dissent. By contrast, blackness not only negates the exclusive authority of white cultural orthodoxy, it suggests the possibility of reconciling dissent with belongingness and the theoretical possibility of generating American authenticities that lie beyond both blackness and whiteness. On the matter of American national conscience, one need only consider the kinds of vitriol that can be spewed about Islam and Muslims with impunity, and compare this with what can be said about blacks or any other race for our race. Again, my point here is not to extol blackness, but to point out, or to point to, what is forfeited by the racial and Nazi embrace by many Muslims in America. By allowing America to feign colorblindness, one allows her the advantage of assuming innocence as a point of departure. From here, it is only Islam and Muslims and Sharia, etc., that need to adjust and apologize, while anti-Muslim bigotry is effectively placed beyond critique. Even Islamophobia can be denied on the argument that American fears about Islam and Muslims are not irrational, but quite founded. By contrast, when House Majority Leader Trent Lott remarked as early as 2002, less than a decade ago, that we would have avoided many problems had we listened to the suggestions of the famous segregationist Ron Furman, Lott was relieved of his post as Senate Majority Leader. Imagine what would have happened if Lott had simply stated that we would have avoided many of the problems that we are now facing had we listened to those who opposed rescinding the National Origins Act that allowed for the immigration of Muslims from the Muslim world into America. Or imagine what would have happened had the 2002 D.C. snipers, John Adam Muhammad and Lee Boyd Malibu, both of whom were black, imagine what would have happened had they turned out to be Arab or Indo-Pakistani. Clearly, inclusion in American whiteness does not provide Muslims with this kind of insulation. The question, therefore, is where do American Muslims go from here? And how can American non-Muslims be most effectively brought face-to-face with the fact of their anti-Muslim bigotry? Regarding the issue of the possibility of alternative modalities of Westernism, this is a huge matter for which space will not allow a full treatment. Three quick points, however, may begin to light the way. First, without the possibility of non-white Western authenticity, the alienation that continues to haunt so many Muslim immigrant youth will continue unabated. Such alienation being fertile ground for seeds of radical extremism and violence. Second, without the possibility of genuine non-white Westernism, there can be no real, credible, effective internal Muslim critique of Western thought and institutions. External critique will continue, to be sure. But given the imbalance in cultural and intellectual authority between the Muslim world and the West, this is not likely to go very far. Third, without the possibility of non-white Westerners, one can only wonder about the possibility of genuine organic group alliances between Muslims and non-Muslims in America. Black Americans already have, including Black American Muslims, their natural ally in the form of the Black American community at large. Who will play this role for Muslims who immigrated to this country from elsewhere? Finally, on the question of American redemption, refusing to recognize race allows Americans to conduct themselves in essentially racist ways while being able to deny racism and thus the propriety of any redress. In other words, there is nothing in their treatment of Islam or Muslims for which Islamophobic Americans need to redeem themselves. Part of the key to all of this, however, is the effective erasure of blackness and race from the national conscience and discourse. This is why one of the arguments routinely adduced to deny that Islamophobia has anything to do with racism is to insist that Islam is not a race. Once race and blackness are removed from consideration, so too is the need for any vigilance, discipline, or redemption. Anti-Muslim bigots are simply able to relocate the problem in the despised Muslims themselves. Given their alien status as socially neither black nor white, and given that they are now taken to be the representatives of Islam, Arabs are particularly vulnerable to the kinds of stereotype and demagogic vilification that follows from this. In fact, at the risk of wearing out my welcome at this late stage, let me just end here with a brief example that will hopefully demonstrate my point. On September 22, 2008, less than 2 months before the presidential election, conservative pundit Rush Limbaugh delivered a message designed to turn white voters away from presidential candidate Barack Obama. Limbaugh noted that many, particularly white blue-collar workers, could not bring themselves to vote for Obama because he was black. He also said, however, that the number of whites who were alienated by Obama's blackness might not be enough to ensure a McCain victory. So he set out to find a more secure basis for turning white voters away from Obama. During the course of his radio broadcast, he declared the following, and I'm quoting here, and the best person of all voices that I did must have been. These polls, these polls of how one-third of blue-collar white Democrats won't vote for Obama because he's black. But he's not black. Do you know he has not one shred of African blood? He doesn't have any African. That's why when they asked whether he was authentic, whether he's down for the struggle, he's Arab. You know, he's from Africa. He's from Arab parts of Africa. He's not African American. The last thing he is African American. End of quote. To be sure, Limbaugh is a shrewd propagandist who knows his audience and his craft quite well. In order to augment the number of whites who would not vote for Obama, he deemed it necessary to negate Obama's blackness and to affirm that Obama was an Arab. Of course, Limbaugh knew that he was misrepresenting Obama. In an earlier broadcast on August 19, 2008, he complained that no young Democrat, and I'm quoting here, had the guts to stand up and say no to a black guy. So he knew that Obama was black. By late September, however, he realized that America was serious about seizing this historical opportunity for redemption. He also recognized, however, that the redemption vote could be undermined if he could find a way to negate the very basis of any need for redemption. By insisting that Obama was not black, in other words, Limbaugh was implying that there would be no redemption in voting for him. Then, in order to reinforce this negation, he set out to place Obama in a category he deemed least likely to elicit any American empathy. From here, not only could the most ridiculous things be said, believed, and feared about Obama, this could be executed with total impunity. To conclude, from 1790 up until 1952, race remained an explicit constituent of the definition of an American. The National Origins Act of 1924 was basically an implicit extension of this policy. Thus, in effect, race continued to play an official role up until 1965. In this light, I have argued that race is integral to American reality. Moreover, I have implied there can be no effective or responsible thinking about Islam in America, including the possibility of altering the Islamophobic present, without coming to terms with the reality of race, engaging it, and assessing the nature and utility of recognizing this basic fact. Of course, this is not likely to sit with those Muslims who hold that as a universal religion for all peoples, all times, and all places, Islam simply does not and cannot do race. In response to these people, I would simply submit that beyond its fundamentals, and the concrete consensus reached by Muslims in real space and time, Islam as a totally undifferentiated and uniform entity is nothing but an imagined abstraction. In America, Islam will have to engage race, just as Islam in many parts of the Muslim world must engage and has engaged the reality of tribe. And here I must admit that I do not see any functional difference between the two, especially if we separate race from racism. In the same way that we separate tribe and the value of tribal belongingness from various negative forms of tribalism. But even beyond the significance of race for Muslims in America, I believe that race is important for America as a whole, as the most likely and efficient instrumentality for keeping America honest, humble, vibrantly pluralistic, and necessarily committed to a negotiated over a superimposed national identity. Just as tribe and tribal unity could be challenged to positive ends in the Prophet Muhammad's Arabia of the 7th century, so might race in modern America be so challenged. In fact, on this understanding, race, as I have suggested earlier, may ultimately prove to be America's unwitting gift to herself. And I'm thinking here especially when we think about the differences between America and Europe right now. For on the one hand, power, wealth, and influence shorn of conscience naturally court disaster for any nation. Race, meanwhile, and most especially American blackness, is a major preservative of American historical memory and a reliable animator of American national conscience. On the other hand, the natural order of society is in fact diversity. How much, when, why, and how long diversity must yield to the value of unity is among the defining features of the challenge of modernity. In America, the nativistic and often tyrannically homogenizing ambitions of the majority, along with its promises of false inclusion, will always smack up against and be retarded by the nagging nemesis of American blackness. Surely, it must behoove American Muslims and Americans overall who think more seriously about whether and how to invest in race or continue to diverse from race. From race as an inextricable part of the American reality. Thank you very much.
I think that there are cultural dislocations.
culture has existed in whatever country they happen to come from. And it's been it's a very difficult transition to let go of something when that to which you're supposed to be trying to attach yourself is itself not fully formed yet. And so I think that American Muslims are culturally in a transitionary stage. They are trying to find avenues to healthy cultural expressions of Islam in America that resonate in an American context, but that also reflect their values and sensibilities as Muslims. And I don't think that we should forget the fact that if critical mass of Muslims do not begin to settle in America until 1965, right? Muslims have been here less than half a century. So there's some time that's going to be required for this to come about. Now, none of that is to make excuses. And if I thought that excuses were enough, I wouldn't be up here saying some of the rather dangerous things that I've said. And I think that some of the issues that you point out, the laziness in terms of how we think about Islam in the context of America, the unwillingness or the inability to take America as seriously as our homeland, all right, as we take other parts of the Muslim world. We have to remember that Islam, by the time that the Prophet died, had only one sort of homeland. That was Arabia. And not all Arabia had that. Islam had to go into all of these different countries, all right, and process these cultures in line of its own religious sensibilities, out of which you get, you know, this beautiful collage of what became Muslim cultures and societies. I see no reason why that process should stop at the shores of the Atlantic. That process has to continue here in America. And one of the things that retards that process is that, again, America is very unique among Western democracies. This is the only democracy that has a major segment of its Muslims coming from an indigenous population. You don't have that in the States. You don't have that in France. You don't have that in Germany. You don't have that in England. They're all immigrants. Here, black Americans born, raised in America, been here for centuries, a major constituent of the American Muslim community. Why has the cultural genius, and I mean that, I use that word neutrally, of this group of Muslims been ignored, if not suppressed? I think that what we need to understand is that part of the future of America, not the future of America, but of Islam in America, will be determined not simply by what Muslims can come up with in terms of this ruling or that ruling at Islamic law, but whether or not Muslims can actually produce a livable social and cultural order. That more than anything else will determine the future of this community in America. I hope I answered this somewhat.
I'm always new. Alright? It's just a new victim. Alright? Muslims who came to this country and ignored America, alright, did not understand, perhaps because it didn't affect them, alright, that this kind of tendency existed in our society. And that we don't collectively conduct ourselves in a way to minimize the negative effects of that, it will rear its head again. Alright? That's what I think that Muslims have to understand. I also think, however, that, you know, Muslims come to America and enjoy untold advantages. And I've lived in the Muslim world for years. So I know. And I can tell you, when I go abroad, you can take my shoes, you can take my money, don't take Big Blue. I don't know if you know what Big Blue is. But don't mess with that passport, because I'm going home. So Muslims enjoy untold advantages. Muslims have to recognize, however, just like the Prophet did when he went from Mecca to Medina, that in the same way that I fully partake of the advantages of America, I am also responsible, all right, for the failures of America. And I am also involved, therefore, in that quest to make right, and to do right on those failures. Not simply here to take, all right? And not contribute to the cumulative, you know, record of America's attempt to live up to her own ideals. That's what I think is important about Muslims understanding the black experience. All right? A white American Muslim told me this. You remember the Part 51 thing that was going on? Yes. Ground Zero Mosque? Yeah. Oh, that's right. That was overshadowed by your own local event. Anyway, quite a random Muslim who said to me that, you know, Muslims somehow don't seem to quite understand. They think that Islamophobia is something new, all right? The reality is that there has always been a bigotry addict in our midst in America. The civil rights movement sent that bigotry addict into rehab. Now he's back out, and he's on the bottle again. And what we, so why American Muslims said this to me, and what we have to understand is that this exists. And collectively, we have to make our contribution to making sure that the bigotry addicts don't get out of rehab and wreak havoc on society. And it might not be you, it may be somebody else. It's still the bigotry addict, and that's still a liability for us all. Right? And I'll say something here that, you know, it's not often popular in certain circles. You know, it's people like Abraham Joshua Heschel, the Jewish rabbi, who I'm often extremely admirable of. I admire the fact that he's a man who came to America after the time that Jews had succeeded in gaining admission into American whiteness, could have simply, I'm white, let me go and do my thing. And yeah, I know there's some bad things happening out there, but they don't affect me, and go on about his life. This man marched with Martin Luther King. Right? And that is the moral caliber of Muslims that we need to be critiquing. Not just about Muslims. Right? What about anybody who's a victim of that bigotry addict that has been running around in our country virtually from the beginning? I hope that answers your question.
Compared to what Muslims experience. over the course of American history, you know, there's always been an other. It's really easy to point at someone else and say, that's the bad guy, that's the bad guy. But it's my understanding that it's the ideal of out of many one, that we're all one people, and that the best way to exalt that American ideal is to elevate the human woman, right? The human community. And that not to focus just on one identifying feature. But as you were saying just recently, of yes, ask everyone, ask the Irish, ask the Catholics, ask everyone, because it's happened time and time again. And yeah, we're on the same page now.
Thank you, Dr. Jackson, so much for your Hello. Sorry. Our next event is next week, Tuesday, February 15th. We'll be screening a movie called Bilal's Band, which is about a young Muslim who is in high school and wants to go to college, but he can't afford it, essentially speaking. So he sneaks in a college application, and he gets in, but he has to find money for it. So it's his adventure of how to balance family life with possibly going to college. It's at 8 p.m. in the Red Team Auditorium, and it's co-sponsored with Grow Up Entertainment. Our second lecture event will be on February 16th. It's called Islam 101. So basically, if you have any questions about Islam, this is the meeting you should probably go to. It will feature Dr. Ali Shahdata, and it will be at 7 p.m. in the Grand Ballroom. And to find out more about these events, go to www.islamoncampus.com. I'll say that one more time. www.islamoncampus.com. Also, if you are here for extra credit, please don't forget to sign in at the front desk downstairs, so that way you can get your AHL along, which is not really. Also, Dr. Jackson's books are, one of his books are on sale downstairs, so the other books will be providing them, so if you'd like to purchase a copy, you can just make your way downstairs to that as well. Oh yeah, also, I don't know if you can see this, but this is an awesome button, right? And it says Islam Awareness Month. So if you haven't already, pick up a button. There are some out on the outside tables. And second to last, we'll be having our Isha prayer, our final prayer, here on the stage, which is kind of odd, we'll be having it on stage. But before we do that, I'd like to invite Sister Summer Iqbal. She has something very legitastic for you to see on stage, and she'll explain it more in detail. So with that said, Sister Summer Iqbal.
Thank you.